Howdy everyone, I'm one of your Blue Jeans and Boots hosts, Anthony Matarazzo, here to let you know that the Interdisciplinary Graduate Program in Genetics and Genomics at Texas A&M University is currently accepting applications for our PhD program. Whether you've listened to our podcast for a while, or are new here and have been thinking about going to graduate school, check out our flyer posted on our website at genetics.tamu.edu. Our program is truly interdisciplinary and includes developmental biology, evolutionary genetics, bioinformatics, plant genetics, medical and applied sciences, and so much more. Come learn from researchers in over a dozen departments and find your scientific passion today. The application is free and the stipend is competitive. Learn more on our website at genetics.tamu.edu. Now, let's talk about some science.
Hi, Kevin. Hi. Good, how are you?
Good.
You out here?
You're making me nervous. Y'all can edit everything, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. Good. No. It's
we're good. I can say whatever then, you know.
Any egregious mistakes can be.
Oh, this is one take?
One continuous take.
Wow.
It's live, actually. They can hear us right now. Our entire audience.
Everyone knows who I am. Anyone that knows me is like, oh, it's just that guy. It's cool.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll get started. Howdy everyone, you're listening to Blue Jeans and Boots, where genetics grad students talk about how to navigate a PhD program while trying to stay sane. We also invite faculty from our interdisciplinary program here at Texas A&M onto the show and pick their brains about their research, what it's like to be a principal investigator, and their journey to becoming a professor here at A&M. In this episode, we'll talk to Dr. Kevin Bredmeier. Kevin is a bioinformatics scientist at Catalytic Data Science. He earned a PhD in genetics and genomics from our program here at A&M in 2021. And we're looking forward to hearing about what he's been up to since his time in the program. I'm one of your co-hosts today, Aaron.
And I'm your other co-host, Serena.
Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
We're excited to have you here today. So, to get things started, could you tell us a little bit about the research you did while you were here in graduate school?
Okay, yeah. So, my research was with Dr. Bill Murphy and focused mostly on, at first, looking at hybrid sterility in various cat species, mostly focused on the savannah cat. So it's a cross between an African serval and a domestic cat. And so what we wanted to do is, let me back up a little bit. So that was the original focus by a previous grad student. I focused on the Chowsea, which is a jungle cat and a domestic cat. Mm-hmm. And so what my purpose was to kind of figure out what was going on in terms of hybrid sterility in that, I lost the volume, is that okay? Oh, okay, sorry. I was making sure that was okay. was just to investigate hybrid sterility in that case. And so I focused on the X chromosome and conformation change. And so usually the X chromosome is a really interesting chromosome because it undergoes conformation change in females whenever there's one X inactivated. And so what actually happens is in males during spermatogenesis, the X chromosome also undergoes a similar change, we think. It's different in that it's packaged separately because you don't have an autosome to pair with it during meiosis. So I focused mostly on that and infertility, but the issue was cats didn't have, they had a really good reference genome, it's just it wasn't totally complete or complete enough, you know, for Bill. So what we did was we used F1 hybrids, so in this case the jungle cat. Mm-hmm. Is an F1 hybrid, you know, between domestic and jungle cat. So we wanted to pull apart genomes. And so what we did was we got a Bengal, which is another similar hybrid. So it's a hybrid between an Asian leopard cat and a domestic cat. And so using that hybrid, because we already had cell lines for it, we did what's called haplotyping, so single haplotype assemblies. So you use it, you know, you normally have a diploid organism with haplotypes from either parent. And so in this case, since the two parents are different species, we were able to pull apart the reads and assemble them separately so that you have a single haplotype. So one of the things with sterility is since it's such a complicated process, they figured it was something to do with large macrosatellites and things that aren't normally in the assemblies already. And so by having these better assemblies, we were really able to sort of drill down to what might be causing the infertility. And so it kind of turned into mostly focused on sterility to kind of just becoming like genome assembly master and trying to figure out the best ways to assemble genomes and to get single haplotype assemblies for a majority of cat species. So we did the Bengal, which gave us Asian leopard cat and the domestic cat. So we already had a domestic cat reference, but this was a better version. And then we had an Asian leopard cat. You know, we called it the twofer because it was a two for one. and then we also did a similar thing with the liger, which gave us the lion and tiger assembly. And so at the end, you know, we ended up having several cat assemblies that now we can do comparative genomics with really good genomes. Whereas before, it's hard to get really good reference genomes for multiple species that you're, you know, interested in because it takes a lot of work to get. And so that was sort of my focus while I was here at A&M.
That is wild. And I have to ask, when you say jungle cat, is that any wild cat or is there a specific cat called a jungle cat?
It's the Felis chaus is a jungle cat. So
I had never even heard of that. Okay, I just wanted to check.
Yeah.
Just curious, what was your background with bioinformatics before you came here? How much did you learn while on the job here versus what you had in undergrad?
So I had hardly any bioinformatics experience whatsoever. Even wet lab experience, I was pretty minimal. I grew up on a farm, and so growing up in a small town, we didn't have access to high-level science learning. And so pretty much when I came to A&M for my undergrad and did some rotations, rotations for the gene undergrad program, I kind of, you know, learned some things about DNA extractions and stuff. And then I went and worked for Syngenta for a couple years doing all field work. And so when I came into grad school, it was pretty much ground zero. I mean, I had done minimal wet lab experience and pretty much no bioinformatics. So it was, starting fresh.
Wow. Oh my God. What did you work on while you were at Syngenta for a few years?
So I was a wheat trialing manager. So we would have several different wheat varieties that were bred through the greenhouse up through seven generations or whatever. And then we would go plant them at various places and perform selections on them to see, you know, this variety has powdery mildew resistance. This variety is drought tolerant. And then that's how we'd make selections for the next year in the greenhouse. And then we'd bring those up through yield trials into what we call marketable, you know, varieties that we'd sell to farmers. And so, yeah.
Look at that.
We can both sympathize with you on the field work.
Yeah, figured y'all could. I know you can for sure.
I have a question for you about a process you used to run in Dr. Murphy's lab. Can you tell us a little bit about trio binning and how that's been used to generate assemblies?
Going back, that's sort of, you know, what I was discussing before, where it's pretty much the idea of you have a hybrid individual, which, you know, has two different parent species or two different species as parents. And so normally if you want to pull a diploid apart and the parents are of the same species, there's not enough differences in individual reads. In this case, you always use long reads and you use short reads to pull them apart. So you pretty much just align the short reads to the long reads and you can separate them out that way. And so since we have long reads now, we're able to separate them into individual species because those species are different enough. And so trio binning can be used for pretty much any hybrid except for that it has to have a large enough divergence time between species. And so in the case of cats, what's crazy is like different cat species hybridize across really large branches. They're really, really distant evolutionarily. And so it makes it easy to split these hybrids out in cat species in particular. But I mean, in theory, I mean, we can do it with coyote wolf hybrids, different whale hybrids. They've, you know, thought about doing it. I think Dr. Rodseff's lab has done it with the mule, so the donkey and the horse. And so, you know, it can be done as long as the species are different enough.
Above our pay grades, perhaps.
Until it's not.
I was going to say, as the person here who knows the least probably about bioinformatics on this episode, trio binning, so that's aligning short reads to long reads.
Yes, and it pretty much identifies the long read as this haplotype or this haplotype, one parent or the other.
Okay.
Yeah, very so cool. You'd have, ideally, the two parental Illumina reads. So you'd have, you know, the parent domestic cat and the parent Asian leopard cat Illumina reads, and then you have the F1 hybrid long reads. So you can, you know, it depends on that accuracy in terms of, because if you use a different individual, they might have, you know, point mutations here and there that you might miss some of the long reads and they would be ambiguous, so it wouldn't know which parent to go to necessarily. Okay. So it's always better to have the real parents, which makes, with cats, it's awesome because, you know, they do all these hybridizations in the pet trade. So you have Bengals and Savannahs and things that are sold as pets, and so you almost always have parents like a trio. So you have parents and an offspring that you can get blood from and get all the, you know, get the DNA from. But in the wild, it's a little harder, you know.
Yeah, I would imagine.
If you just find a hybrid, you know, polar bear grizzly roaming around, it's hard to know where its parents are. So
you're telling me you can't just approach a hybrid grizzly polar bear and be like, hey, can I have just a little bit of your blood? Is that
yeah
cool?
You could get its blood, but finding its parents' blood, you know, it might not know where, you know, where mama is. So
aww,
yeah,
poor bear.
Yeah, no.
Did you spend any time with the cats up in the
no
facility?
Fortunately, I say fortunately because apparently some of the wild species were pretty wild. The Asian leopard cat is pretty notorious, I think, for being pretty catty, if you will.
Okay.
So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, a normal domestic cat on steroids. And so I didn't spend any time with the cats, but Bill has his frozen zoo with all these cell lines that he's collected over the years, and he has really good connections with breeders and different other cat organizations. So that's where lots of our tissue and stuff like that came from.
And do you know if triobinning's been applied for other organisms? I know you said it's possible that it could work for other species. Do you know about any that have been?
Yeah, so originally it was first tested in sort of, I guess, the proof of concept was shown on cattle species.
Mm-hmm.
So two different cattle species formed a hybrid. It's like the Highland cattle and a regular Bos taurus.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to separate those into two individual haplotypes. And then they did a yak and a cow second. So a little more, divergent than the other two. And so it was a little easier, you know, a little more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to say the cat was what we did was the third. But since then, I think like Rod Steph's done the mule and then, or the henny, I guess it's the inverse reciprocal cross. I think others are, I've done some stuff before I left looking at coyote wolf hybrid. So, but other than that, there's probably more now. I mean, now that it's out there, who knows what's in the works.
Yeah, right.
What was the, if you can remember back, what was the easiest and the toughest genomes to work on of the cats or other animals?
Oof. So the cats were pretty clean. I was always called spoiled by
our bat-focused
postdoc who, you know, bats are pretty crazy with all the viral insertions and stuff like that. Right. And so a lot of chromosomes. But cats pretty simple. I mean, they're way more similar karyotypically to humans than even mouses.
Okay.
So similar number of chromosomes, X looks relatively the same. Like looking at the coyote and dog, I mean, dog has way more chromosomes. I'm probably gonna get this wrong, but I think like 38 chromosomes relative to the cat. And then, the worst to work on was the aardvark because where a cat is like 2.4 gigs of sequence, the aardvark is like 5.
Oh, wow.
But it has a similar number of genes. So all that extra stuff is repetitive elements that'll break assemblies, lots of repetitive DNA. And for the aardvark, which we've looked at, it doesn't actually have, it wasn't triobend. So it didn't have a single haplotype. So anywhere you have haplotype, what we call discrepancies. So say you have like a mini satellite, say it's like 500 base pairs and it's repeated 100 times in one haplotype. And then you have that same satellite repeated 500 times. In another, you know, so 5 times more copies.
Right.
It might not do anything in terms of the fitness of the organism, but when you try and assemble it, the assembler gets to that point and all the reads look the same and it goes, it has a hard time estimating how many copies to put in.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of times it'll just put a gap there. A gap is just a run of ends that says, hey, you know, we don't know if these two go together because the reads aren't long enough to span across the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where lots of the breaks occur in the assemblies, and that's where you kind of lose information. And so if you were to align those reads back to that on either side of the gap, you know there was something more there because you'd get really big spikes. Like if you ever look at IGV plot, you know, you'll see plots where the reads will start to pile up, and it's trying to put them there, but you know, there's a big gap in the sequence. So yeah, so the aardvark is, you know, crazy.
That's kind of wild.
Wouldn't have expected that.
No, not at all. I didn't even know that you worked on aardvark while you were here, that you knew, you know, anything about aardvark.
Yeah,
so I was like, Kevin's the cat guy.
Yeah, I became the genome assembly guy. You know? That's just how quick things transition. You know? You go from being cat dog guy one day and you wake up.
Wow.
And you're aardvark guy.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, we've talked about all the skills that you learned throughout graduate school coming in with limited bioinformatics and even wet lab experience. Have you gotten to use a lot of those skills in your career so far that you picked up while you were here?
So, yes and no. So bioinformatically, absolutely I have.
Awesome.
But, you know, I took my current position and I knew it was more bioinformatically focused. But pretty much all my wet lab skills I learned from back extraction to high C, generating high C libraries and Oxford Nanopore, running the Nanopore and stuff like that. I haven't used any of that, sadly. So I haven't got to do any wet lab work, so my hands are getting rusty. but yeah, bioinformatically, man, it was really helpful to, it's not fun to learn it on your own at first, mm-hmm. but when you do and you immerse yourself in it, it's like any other thing. You kind of pick things up here and there. And now that I'm, you know, out in the wide world and doing these jobs, you find that even some of the higher level like customers that are working on cancer research and this and that, and some of the, you know, industry companies, they don't really know what they need necessarily. So it's mm-hmm. helpful to have experienced and had a wide verse, you know, be really versatile and have experienced lots of different things. So you can say, hey, I remember this tool, and then you can go look at it and it turns out, hey, this is more up to date, you know, let's use this instead of that. And so it was really helpful just to have dabbled in everything from RNA-seq to Hi-C to variant calling to genome assembly. And so, yeah, I mean, that helped a ton just doing lots of different stuff. Wow.
What was your greatest resource while learning bioinformatics? Was it classes or YouTube/forums?
So people learning bioinformatics itself, I mean, classes and yeah, just trying to absorb what reading papers and what everyone else is doing. You see a tool in a paper and you're like, wow, I wonder what that is. And you go and look, and if you know, the first couple ones you do, you're like, that's gibberish. And you know, of course, when you see math and the methods, you immediately just skip to the end.
No, of course.
So, you know, just kind of trying to find practical applications and then, you know, saying like, hey, will this work to use and stuff like that. But in terms of like actual, I guess, coding and stuff like that, like having someone in your lab, like I had Wesley Brashear and he helped me with Python and stuff, not in like the hold my hand help me, but just, you know, hey, here's old scripts, here's this and that. So you can kind of begin to pick apart little pieces and put them together in your own way. You know, I think of them as little Lego blocks. Like if I had to sit down and write a Python script for you, I could not do it, but I could go to my old scripts and probably whip something up from right. the pieces. You know, mm-hmm. I could build you a Lego block, you know, script.
Sure.
But yeah, so it's really helpful in both ways, mentorship as well as yeah, just having the opportunity to experience and research a bunch of stuff. And it helps if you don't have a hard deadline, because that stuff is very time consuming.
Yeah,
for sure.
It always takes longer than you think it is.
Oh, I have whole days of notes just saying, well, that didn't work like 10 times on a page. And it's like, you know, tried every single code in every different way, and sometimes it still didn't work out, you know. And mm-hmm. it's sometimes you got to take a break and walk away and come back to it, and it works, you know. Oh, I missed a space here, or a comma there, and then
it's
it works perfectly. Yeah. So it's a little bit of both.
There's definitely a dopamine rush when you hit enter and it
you feel
actually
all
runs
powerful.
Successfully.
Yeah. You're like, I'm the smartest man alive. And
exactly.
then it doesn't, you know, then it's empty output or something.
Right.
And it's like dreams are crushed.
What a roller coaster ride, honestly.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
When you came into graduate school, did you know you wanted to do bioinformatics, or are you just like, I want to work on cats? That's the plan.
I had none of that. So I came, like I said, purely from a plants background. Mm-hmm. In undergrad, I worked for Dr. Mollett doing sorghum research.
Oh, cool.
So all the field work again. But I, after with Syngenta, I was kind of looking for something else. I didn't feel, you know, super challenged academically. And so I came back, and I was one of the few people when I was interviewing for the program that was just like, I'll do anything. Like, I'm interested in all sorts of stuff, and I think a quick learner, so maybe I can try to learn, you know, pretty much whatever you do. And so all my rotations were so varied, from developmental genetics to angiogenesis to then Bill with evolutionary biology and stuff like that. So yeah, pretty much when I went to Bill, I mean, I was just, you know, if you have a cool project, I'm all for it. So yeah. You know, that's, I think, helped, because I was flexible in what I was interested in, because there's just too much to know, you know.
Oh,
even
yeah.
when you come in from undergrad, I mean, I was only out of undergrad for 2.5 years before coming back to grad school, and I just felt like so much was changed
yeah.
in terms of the field and what I'd learned in undergrad versus what I was learning in my first class as a grad student. Yeah, the field just goes so fast. Like, how do you know what you want? So that was the approach I tried to take, and just saying like, hey, I'm flexible. Obviously, if you have interests, follow those. But I mean, I was just, yeah, I was totally open-minded. So, and that was helpful.
Helped you find the right fit?
Yeah, I think so.
So what do you see as some current bottlenecks for bioinformatics, and what do you think would need to change for the field to catch up with the amount of data that's being collected? I know there's a disparity between how much data it's easy to collect, but actually processing and wrangling all that data is very difficult and expensive at the current moment.
Yeah, so actually Catalytic, where I work now, kind of addresses this issue in that it's a platform that makes bioinformatics more accessible to people who are scared of coding, or, you know, that's just a lot to get into, as well as people who don't necessarily have their own server or access to HPRC here at Texas A&M, because we use all AWS. So, and we also generate essentially what we call apps. You know, they're a little tile. Say you want to run, say you want to map your data, your Illumina data to a reference genome. We have a tile that says BWA, and you click on it, and it says input your FASTA. You drag your FASTA in, you hit run, it aligns it to the reference genome of your choice, and spits out a BAM. We also have different tools that are more complex, to where we've weaved in a pipeline to where it runs FastQC, BWA, and then it runs like variant callers, whichever variant caller you want, and then it outputs your variants. So, you know, that helps just make bioinformatics more accessible, because there's way fewer bioinformaticians than there are lab worker or, you know, lab techs and people more that are more lab savvy. And like you said, I mean, one person can make enough libraries to keep a bioinformatician busy for a long while, because those things just take time to run. And so that's another bottleneck, is just the time it takes to run some of this stuff. Some of the variant calling data for like cancer data sets can be like 150, 300x if you're looking for rare variants. And so that takes a really, really long time and a lot of computational power. And so, you know, with our platform, it's cool because it calls up an AWS instance. You can give it as many resources as you want.
Which is Amazon Web Services.
Web Services, okay. Yeah. And then it runs the commands, it downloads your data, spits out the output on the platform, and then it's all there. So that's kind of a cool, that's why I was interested in Catalytic. It was an efficient system that I was like, wow, like if I didn't have a server through Dr. Murphy's lab, I wouldn't have known what to do with all my data, because you can't run it locally on your laptop. I mean, you can run some things, but lots of the really intensive stuff is just too much data, too much memory, you know, and then the outputs lots of times can be tears. And not many laptops have tears and tears of storage.
Not.
You'd have to have an external you're moving off to or something. But so, yeah, that's, yeah.
Unfortunately for you guys, you don't have to have a server room either. Just that's all.
That's right.
Amazon's business. And
yeah, we just pay a pretty penny and, you know,
sure.
There it goes. But,
of course.
Yeah.
Hopefully your clients pay a pretty
that's
penny.
True. That's
right.
Yeah, it's not on the company. We just pay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So what do you do specifically at Catalytic Data Science?
So I'm a bioinformatics scientist, and so pretty much I have more focus than another bioinformatics scientist, Kelsey, who also graduated from here. She's more on the engineering side because that's what she was interested in. It's a relatively young company, so it's kind of nice because you have flexibility in what you're interested in. You can kind of go this way or that. So I have a little more customer interaction, so I can talk to the big customers, and they can say, we want to do this variant calling for these data sets, this and that. And like I was saying earlier, I can look into what tools are available, you know, which are better, which are more recent, which are still being updated and taken care of. And so we can get those on the platform for them, which I also take care of. So I might go to a company and say, hey, you want to use Manta to call structural variants instead of Deli, because Deli's really old. And so then I can go in now and actually get, we do several things. So we got to containerize it, which allows you to install pretty much every aspect of the tool into a container through Docker, so that whenever you spin up an instance, you open this image and it has all the information you need right there. And so I set all that stuff up and pretty much just get the analytic to where it can have a UI built around it.
Okay.
And then they put that on the platform web page, and then anybody of the customers can click on it and run Manta, like with their data sets.
Okay. So providing a lot of accessibility for people that have the background.
Yeah, and also making sure, like, because the engineers, you know, they can do all this stuff and put all these and connect all the wires and get everything going and it look good, but at the end of the day, they don't necessarily know what the output's supposed to look like.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It can spit out an empty VCF and they can go, okay, great. And it's like, well, there's no variants here, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's up to the bioinformatic team to make sure the outputs are what we expect and what the customers would want. And so that's, you know, a big part of why we're there, to help support the engineers in that aspect as well.
And how would you compare industry professional life to being a grad student?
Oh, man. Ooh, there it is. No, I'm just kidding. Well, it's totally different, because when I was in academia here with Bill, you know, and all professors are different. You know, Bill liked a regular schedule where we came in a certain time and we left at a certain time, which I enjoyed that as well, because it kept me accountable. And I was able to focus better and stuff. You know, you have your own space to do your stuff. Now I work remotely from home, so it's a little more difficult especially with like an 18-month-old running around and banging on your door and stuff like that. So you just have to keep the door shut, you know, and, you know, batten down the hatches and really focus on what you're doing. But there's a lot more flexibility in what I do now. They're pretty, as long as I'm getting my work done and I'm accessible, I can pretty much, if I need to run to the dentist, I can run to the dentist. If I need to, you know, if you need to do this and that. And with gas prices, you know, I don't have to go into work every day.
That is great.
It's really awesome. Like, you don't have to spend time in traffic. I mean, there's lots of really good benefits if you can take being sort of isolated.
Like, sure.
We have a stand-up every morning where you discuss what you did yesterday, what you're doing tomorrow, you know, as a team. And there's support there, but it's not the same as walking down to your buddy, you know, in the lab and saying, hey, I'm struggling with this. We need to kind of talk this out. Because you have to say, hey, do you have time to get on a Zoom meeting? Yes, I have time to get on a Zoom meeting. You get on the Zoom meeting. You know, it's just kind of, it's more difficult and it's less natural, I guess, of a feeling.
Sure.
So, and I'm sure there's a lot of good ideas that don't happen because people are working remotely and you can't just, you know.
You don't feel like setting up the link.
Yeah, yeah. You can't just shoot the breeze and kind of figure stuff out and think of new crazy ideas because, you know, it's all very like down to business when you're on a call, you know, just by nature. But.
Do you think you'll switch to working in person soon, or do you think you'll stay remote?
As far as I know, we're supposed to be remote indefinitely. So, yeah, so that'll give me some flexibility to move or go wherever or do whatever. I mean, yeah, so there's a lot of flexibility there as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty nice as long as I have internet. So
definitely.
Yeah, that makes sense. As somebody who gets a little bit caught up in all of the acronyms, and I'm not going to lie, I'm going to Google a lot of things that we are talking about today after this interview is over because I can't even keep track of all the things that I was like, I know what that word is, but man, I don't remember exactly what it means. What advice would you have for young scientists who want to implement bioinformatics into their research, especially if they're coming from just a molecular type background?
I mean, yeah, I would just start with reading paper, like a paper that does something similar that they're doing experimental wise or a similar process in the lab. You know, lots of time it has data analysis following that in the paper. And like I said, you might read it and it'd be total gibberish at first.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of times now with GitLab and stuff like that, it's so easy to go and just search a tool at GitLab. Lots of times they have a README, things like that. And like I said, at first, you'll be doing a lot more Googling than you will be reading the actual GitLab.
Right.
But once you get a lot of things nailed down, you'll say, ah, okay, that makes sense, or this is borrowed from that, or, you know, and then it just, it becomes more and more familiar, and you can slowly begin to integrate things. And then, like Aaron was saying, then you try something and it works, and you're like, wow, like, that's so much easier than if I had done it before. You know, it's just little things like that can be so much more convenient, just reading through the papers and finding stuff.
And how did you find what was the best way for you to document everything you've learned? Because I know at least in my experience I'll write some script and then it's a little .txt file that's just floating around on my hard drive somewhere. So did you compile all of your successful scripts or your notes from reading about what other people did?
Totally. So that was I try to be organized. Everyone, Bill used to make fun of me because I was pretty meticulous about the, he'd say, who cleaned up in here? Because he couldn't find anything that he was looking for. But I always used OneNote, Microsoft OneNote. So you can I have a journal every day, even if it's something as silly as, you know, hey, I didn't work for an hour because I went to the dentist because I'm like, well, you know, what happened here? Like, why didn't I do this?
Okay.
But you can put check boxes and to-dos and things like that. So every single day I have something and then I just copy and paste, take screenshots. I copy and paste pretty much every time I run something. I'll copy and paste in, even if I know it's going to work. Because then if you go back and the results don't look like you thought they would, in the back of your mind, you're like, did I accidentally call the wrong input file or the wrong output file?
Okay.
Or, you know? So, you know, with doing all these different cat species and stuff like that, maybe I copy and pasted a code in from 2 months ago and I want to run it for the tiger, but I still have line as like the input file.
Mm-hmm.
But I name the output tiger and then suddenly, you know, whoops. So it's always nice to be able to go back and see exactly what you used. Like I just copy and paste, ran this, ran that. I need to run this afterwards. You know, if it's getting toward the end of the day, my brain doesn't store a lot of information for long periods of time. So I have to leave notes.
Yeah, that's.
So I'll have check boxes that you can go in and say like, okay, yes, I ran that or I migrated that to here. Because backing up data is huge. Like you said, with all this data, it's very easy to lose, you know, $3,000 worth of sequencing data. Because you thought it was there and it wasn't. Especially if you're doing stuff in command line, you know, you accidentally RM something and it's gone forever. And Yeah, painful. So it's really nice just to have something to dump all your thoughts on.
Okay. So using an app such as OneNote or
That was my best, just because I could do pages and copy and paste, and that's pretty much, I think, what our lab uses now is OneNote, just because you can, and then you can, you know, whenever you leave or graduate or whatever, you can then save that OneNote file and give it to your PI. Okay. So, you know, you don't get a million emails saying, where's this notebook? You know,
sure, even better than a physical lab notebook.
And you can search in there. Because physical notebook, you're going, oh, God, I remember I write this down, one of these pages. And you see it in your mind, but you can't find it on the page. Mm-hmm. OneNote, you just search, this thing. And then it shows every instance that you typed it in to your journal. And then you're like, oh, look at that. I ran, you know, high C data through on this day, or we received this data on this day or whatever. So it's really convenient.
Did you start programming with like one language, or did you pick up just sort of things you needed here and there?
Yeah, it was very haphazard. It was just thing here and there. Yeah. I tried a couple of just learning Python and stuff, but I didn't use them day to day. I would, you know, need Python, and then I would try to learn it, and then I wouldn't need it again for long periods of time. So I would forget about it. And so pretty much I'd have to go back to old scripts and relearn what I was doing, and same with R and things like that. But in terms of languages, like Bash is what I use mostly, just because that's, you could just do quick one-liners, mostly for text manipulation. Like, everybody needs to know how to pull sequence names out, or see how many chromosomes are in a file, or how many sequences, or how many reads do you have. You know, just little things like that that can help you along the way say, hey, are these the right files? Or if something doesn't work out the way you thought, or your output file looks weird, the first place to look is like your input data. If you download something from SRA, lots of times SRA files aren't what you think they are, you know? So it's really important to check and make sure, you know, they're what the author put them in as. So
what has been, I guess, what are some of the most valuable lessons Dr. Murphy had for you as during your time as a graduate student?
Oh man, I mean, a ton. I mean, Dr. Murphy was honestly the best mentor, and I'm not just saying that for the podcast, honestly. I would say if he wasn't. No, he truly was. I mean, he was really laid back. He taught me, like, no matter how fired up I got, thinking like, oh, he's going to be so upset that I don't have this result, it was always like, oh, no, that's fine. Like, totally, I get it. He was always super understanding, and he made me more laid back and understanding in that things aren't going to always work out great, and it's way better to take a step back and think through them and get help and talk to them than to just sit there and pound your head against the keyboard, you know, until you're burned out. And so, yeah, it's huge just to have fun, and science should be fun, you know? And I know you hear that, and it's easy to forget that because some lab chemistry is different or the environment's different. The Murphy Lab was just a super fun environment, and I enjoyed it a lot. And so, you know, that was a great matchup. But I think anybody can hopefully find fun during grad school, whether it's through programs or whatever, or other friends outside, you know, because it should be fun. You should be excited. And, yeah, and it's super helpful to share other things with other people, because the more you talk about it, the more familiar you get with it inherently, you know, just by explaining it to a buddy who knows nothing about it. Yeah, and then, you know, it just blossoms from there, and it's all good. But, yeah, I mean, he taught me a ton of things, but that was one of the best, because it's like the wisdom more than the knowledge, you know? He has all this knowledge, but he's also wise, like Gandalf. He loves Lord of the Rings.
Well, that's what you hope for in a mentor, I think. That's great.
As somebody who clearly found their match sort of in graduate school, a lot of students have trouble with that. And I mean, our program does rotations so that we can kind of have an opportunity to get to know lots of different mentors. What advice would you give to people that are about to go into their rotations when it comes to looking for a lab, looking for a mentor, so that it's productive the way that yours was?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, and I'm sure they've already heard it before, but I guess chemistry between you and a person is more important than you and a subject, because once you graduate, yes, you're going to be an expert in that area. But I guess my big takeaway from grad school wasn't that I learned about hybrid infertility and cat X chromosomes and, you know, all these things. It was the tools I picked up along the way, and friends I've made and relationships, because it's the tools you can apply to anything. And even with doing your research and your dissertation, you know, the big thing is you're learning a process, and you're learning how to apply this process to anything you want. And so that's the real power in grad school and leaving grad school, because you're getting a toolkit of things that are going to help you with the future. And so if it, you know, if you're crazy excited about a certain subject and it is like awesome and you think you can grind it out, even with a PI that you just really have weird feelings about, I can assure you a bad PI experience can nullify any excitement you have in a subject very quickly. And I mean, it's sad, but you know, it's a long grind. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And you think, I'll just chomp down and just go as fast as I can and get it out of the way. And like, some people can do it, and sometimes it works out, but you're not gonna have as much time to pick up these tools. So that's the thing. You might have a dissertation and a plaque on the wall that says PhD, but you're not going to have the tools that you would have gotten if you enjoyed it and you were able to relax and learn at your own pace and discuss. And, you know, that's one big part about industry now that I miss is being to discuss with professionals. Like, you know, as much as journal club is stressful or was for me, you know, now it's like, oh man, I kind of miss it. Like, whoa, it's weird. So, you know, it's these tools to keep you relevant in the field and, you know, carry on your like research in different aspects that make it like a big deal. So I would say don't get so bogged down in what you're interested in. It's good to know your interests, but I wouldn't let that like kick a good lab out if you're just like, wow, these people are cool, PI's awesome, I love his work schedule and idea of work. You know, different people work differently, so that's important too. So
do you see yourself in this career field, you know, indefinitely, or is there anything else that could draw you away from strict bioinformatics? Could anything bring you back into more hands-on science someday?
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, if I got fired, I'd definitely take a hand. No, I'm just kidding. No, but yeah, no, I'm totally open. Like, I mean, yeah, I even tell Bill all the time, like, you know, like, you know, if something didn't work out or whatever, if I got totally bored, you know, with Syngenta, I said I kind of got bored and wanted to come back into academia. That could happen years down the road. I mean, who knows? I'm sure having kids and stuff will keep me busy, no doubt. But, you know, outside of that, it's like fate has a way of guiding you, you know, where you're going to go. You're going to feel drawn to do certain things anyways, and that's in your nature because you're going to want to do what you think is best. And so, you know, down the road, I feel like, hey, I'm just super bored. This is great and all, but I miss, you know, actively pursuing science. Then, yeah, maybe I would, you know, go back into academia, or you know, there's small colleges around or whatever. So yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean all the cards are on the table for me. I'm always trying to be flexible. So
So based on your years in academia as a scholar and now as an industry professional, what trends are you seeing in science or even bioinformatics, or just I guess broadly science as a whole? What gives you hope for the future of humanity based on what people are working on?
Oh man, future of humanity. I mean, things are just moving so fast. It's wild. I mean, from year to year, things just change so rapidly. And, you know, last year's problem is this year's solution. I mean, it's just, who even knows where we could be in the next 10, 15 years? I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm so thankful I chose the field I did, because it just seems like it's growing like gangbusters. And it's nice to be here and have flexibility and be able to pick and choose sort of what you want to do. But yeah, as a whole, I mean, we're going to come to a crossroads in terms of society, you know, like, what do we do? What don't we do? Not what could we do? What can't, you know?
Right.
Because, I mean, we can pretty much, at some point, I think we'll pretty much be able to do whatever our heart desires. And, I mean, if it can be done, it will be done. But, you know, on the large scale, yeah, it's like, yeah. I mean, hopefully it's just as people come up through the system, you know, ethics are taught and responsibilities are taught, at least to the point that if you have to think about it and take a gamble, you're aware you're taking a gamble and not just blindly busting through for the sake of discovery and getting your name on a paper, you know? So, sure. Or trying to chase a dollar. Like, you know, it's being responsible and thinking who this will affect and how it will mold the future, because it certainly will. There's no doubt in my mind.
Sort of along those lines, I know there haven't been any Nobel Prizes to date that were awarded specifically for bioinformatic research. Do you think that'll change?
Oh, I have no idea. That's way, as y'all said, that's above my pay grade. But I don't know. I mean, I suppose so. I don't know if that would be in programming or how that would work. But because, you know, lots of the leaps have been made in the tools that have been produced and used, like with all the aligners and things like that, where those are really famous and have had great, you know, allowed great strides in genetic research. I mean, they're as much important as, you know, like CRISPR to me, because like, wow, being able to align data that quickly and, you know, it has to be there or else you just have a bunch of letters on a piece of paper. So, you know, without it, you can't have results. So, I mean, I assume one day all this stuff will catch up and the significance will be recognized for sure.
Are there any individuals or scientists in particular that inspired you to pursue this further? Was there anyone, I guess, any pioneers in the field of bioinformatics or your area of research that were a big inspiration?
I mean, sadly, not really, because I just kind of, you know, stumbled into it. And, you know, as I've gone on, you read all the papers and see all the greats and stuff, and you're like, wow, like, these people are like the superheroes of the bioinformatics world. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't know. It's just, yeah. I mean, I don't have any particular, but, you know, it's just coming into it and learning all the different processes and stuff like that. But no, so not really any.
Standing on the shoulders of giants, I guess.
Of course, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, it's such a new field, too, like, relative to a lot of other, like, biology, I guess, that's been going on since, what, like, Gregor Mendel, the father of genetics kind of a thing? But yeah. I don't think he was lining genomes, sadly.
No, maybe on paper. No, I'm
maybe.
No. Yeah, no, no. But yeah, it's so new. And yeah, I mean, down the road, probably. No, I think I never thought of that question before, but I'm sure somebody will get credit for all that.
We've gone really big, so now I'm going to take it really small and ask you something that is not all that related to science. But you said that you had fun during your PhD, you got to relax a little bit. I heard that you are really into Diablo sauce from Torchy's Tacos. So I'm just curious, I heard stories, like rumors, whispers about it.
Whispers.
Is there a story there, Kevin?
With Diablo sauce?
Yeah.
Oh, Diablo sauce is bae. I mean, Diablo sauce is, I would, as Nicole says it, I would be embalmed in Diablo sauce. Like,
that's amazing.
As like my final rite, you know? They could just put me in a canoe of Diablo sauce and shoot flaming arrows at me and that would be fine.
Did any of that happen when you finished your dissertation, you know? Did they just like... douse
oh.
you in Diablo sauce?
Oh, no, they
like
didn't.
A coach
Thank
at
goodness.
The end of a game?
Aww. See, because, I mean, you know, my eyes, getting it in my eyes or sinuses probably would have been
so reasonable.
Would have put
so
a damper
logical.
On the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I did find out one day we went, because Bill, we like to frequent Torchy's as a lab, and there was a man that ordered a queso bowl full of Diablo sauce, and I was like, oh my God, I didn't know I could do that. And so the next time we went, Bill ordered me a bowl of Diablo sauce. And I finished it before we left. And then I wanted to go home and take a nap.
Wow.
But I pushed through because that's what bioinformaticists do.
Power through even after an entire bowl of Diablo sauce.
I looked at my screen with my eyes closed. You know, just.
If anybody takes anything away from this episode, I hope it's that.
Diablo sauce, yeah, for sure.
Shout out to Torchy's.
I know, they're. You know, I'm not being endorsed by Torchy's. But I would take free Diablo sauce for life as an endorsement.
Wow. Well, do you have any advice for if you could go back to even pre-college, what would you tell someone who's just getting started in science on how to live, you know, a successful career as a student and then later on in life? What things would you go back and tell yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I went through multiple majors in undergrad. I started doing something I was comfortable with bioinformatics or I can't remember the name of it. Bioengineering, and I thought it was like genetics, and it was actually like bio and ag engineering was more of like doing reservoirs and dams and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I was familiar with farming, and I thought since I was familiar with that, I didn't want to just go crazy, you know. And then I switched to a different major, and then finally I went to genetics and stuck it out. And you know, my dad was like, "You should have just done that all along. Like, we knew like you wanted to do something like that. So don't let the classes spook you or do anything like that." I didn't like math that much, and I ended up taking every math class at A&M by switching so many majors. So I could have just bit the bullet and did it all the first time instead of taking extra ones. But, I would just say follow what you're interested in. I mean, don't let it have an outlook for the future and stuff like that. I mean, there's certain things nowadays that you don't necessarily need to go to college for and stuff. But, like, if you're interested in science, I mean, get in and just go after whatever you're interested in and do additional research. And professors, now that I've been in grad school, I didn't know this in undergrad, but grad school, I learned, like, professors like Bill and others, I'm sure, love when undergrads, you know, approach them and are interested in their research and are interested in learning more, because they love to have undergrads come in the lab and, you know, teach them the ropes and stuff. You know, that's why they're here in academia, partly, a lot of them, is because they want to teach others and they want to help others learn. As an undergrad, like, don't be afraid to approach a professor. If you had a cool lecture and you're like, you know, you relate to something they say, like, go up and ask more questions or see if you want to do like a 2-week long rotation in their lab. You know, it's lots of times they're like, yeah, totally. Like, just come on in and see the lab culture and stuff like that. Because, you know, science isn't like in the movies where you're, you know, necessarily like BSL-4 lab, you know, super high up. Like, you know, it's cool. It's something you can do on your computer at home lots of times, like bioinformatics. And so, yeah, just don't be scared to approach it. And like, I mean, yeah, just follow what you're interested in.
That's advice that I wish that I had when I had started my undergrad. It's like, by the way, your professors, they're people. You can go talk to them. I remember thinking my professors were so cool and the things they were doing were interesting, but I never approached them. And that's something that I wish that I had been more comfortable to do.
Yeah, same. Same.
So try to create opportunities where they're not very obvious.
Yeah, exactly.
Forging connections with people.
Yeah, and just think, yeah, like Serena was saying, yeah, they're people. You know, they go home, they eat dinner, they go to bed. Like, they think about science instead of watching TV. They just sit on the couch. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah,
some of them.
Yeah, who knows? Not me, but yeah, like yeah, just talk to them and I mean get to know them and if they are super cool, then you'll know it really quick, you know, and you'll be drawn to that and that could boom, there it is right there. That could be the start to your scientific career. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Kevin, for being here today. We've had so much fun talking to you. It's been awesome. Today's episode was hosted by Serena and
Aaron.
And this podcast is brought to you by the Texas A&M Interdisciplinary Graduate Program in Genetics and Genomics. If you have any questions about the genetics program or what we talked about today, please feel free to email us at bluejeansandboots@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Genetics Podcast. Thank you for listening to Blue Jeans and Boots, and we'll see you next time.